Over the past five decades, John Malcheri has conducted symphonies, operas, ballets, musicals, and film music around the world, and has served as music director of four opera companies and three orchestras, as well as the host of television and radio programs. He's the author of the new book, For the Love of Music, A Conductor's Guide to the Art of Listening. The book is published by Knopf, and it's a great pleasure to welcome John Malcheri to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, hi, Joe. It's good to be here.
Given that you've been a teacher, a conductor, a musician for so long, what is it that you wanted to tackle in this particular volume?
I thought it would be useful or helpful to share some of the experiences of loving music, of being a musician, as a way of kind of opening the door to people who love it or aren't quite sure or think they don't know enough about it, people who already go and attend classical music concerts and want, you know, more loving, expression of what it all is, and for people who are curious. I was thinking of writing a book that was meant to be, you know, something that would last a long time. You know, Leonard Bernstein wrote The Joy of Music, and that was a long time ago. And before that, Aaron Copland wrote What to Listen for in Music, and that was in the 1940s. So in a way, I was trying to write a book for the 21st century, because there's so many ways to listen to music and because music is available all the time to people. It's meant to look at, you know, do you have to pay attention? Is it background music? What happens if you go to a concert and you've never heard the piece of music before? Is there a way to prepare for it? What is it about music? And I wanted to get to the fundamental issue, which is that music is an invention by humans. And it's a strange invention because if you think about it, it doesn't, you know, feed your family. It doesn't protect you against weather situations. I mean, when first creating music, back when, you know, the time when maybe we were inventing language, why did we do it? You know, it's like, clearly, think about the first flute or the first, you know, that was really a bone that was on the ground of some animal and somebody blew breath into it and it made a sound. And okay, and then what did you do? First of all, why did you do that in the first place? But think about that and how that turns into a flute. So every time you go to a concert, anytime you look at the instruments, you might want to think about this amazing history that starts thousands and thousands of years ago and ends up being a flute, a clarinet, a trumpet, a violin, most unlikely thing of all. So in a way, I wanted to tell people that in a way, music and humans, we are music, and music is us. And that's probably the final line about the entire book.
You say in the introduction that your goal is to help us enjoy classical music more, and you say, quote, with classical music, there is always more. Did you always know that?
I don't know if I always knew that, because when I first started hearing it when I was a kid, I just loved it. I loved what it sounded like. And I wanted, because I've spent a lifetime in it and being with it and having it journey with me, I thought it would be useful, because some people worry that audiences are older. Well, I wanted to say, well, that's okay, because classical music is actually a very adult art form. It deals with really adult issues. Once you enter it and it enters you, it travels with you your whole life. And so there's so many studies going on of people who are older or suffering dementia or physical impairment, but when music is played to them, music that they've loved throughout their lives, it's a conduit back to a previous time. So I think I wanted to talk about this amazing phenomenon that you can be attracted to it when you're 4 years old or 5 years old, as I did, and I've seen kids do that. Other people come to it when they're 40 or 50 or 70 or 90. I wanted to say that that time spectrum is quite elastic. Once you start to love Tchaikovsky or Mozart or Beethoven, or it doesn't really matter, that composer is a kind of a mirror of who you are. And so one of the things about classical music is that you're always changing. So even when you hear the same piece again and again, even if it's a recording, so it's exactly the same, you're different and where you are is different. So each experience is an experience that kind of tells you who you are and journeys with you. So the reason I said more is because classical music you know, is actually in many ways simple. It's not really that complicated at all. In fact, the central repertory is very small, and it covers a very short period of time, unlike, say, visual art. You can love art that goes right back to prehistoric times and modern art and 19th century art and impressionism. But with classical music, there is a core repertory, and it really is a very limited amount of time, which really starts around 1700 and ends around 1930, more or less. So it's a very short period of time. So once you start getting interested in it, you can, you know, love it and not feel so inundated that there's so much music that I could never start. So there's always more because the music progresses through time. You know, that's the other point about music. It's invisible. Now, every art form you can think of is visible except music. Music can accompany visible things, but the actual thing itself is sound waves, right? Right? It's sound. It's invisible. Right. So how do you experience it? And that's what makes it so interesting, because it pervades the room. It pervades your life. It's something that you travel with on the subway or reading a book or at a concert or just half asleep. It's something, you know, in many, many thousands of years ago, the Chinese thought of music as being part of public administration, not an art, because it controls behavior. You know, it's why music is played in a department store, or why it's played in a discotheque, or what is the point of that? It's not just a concert. We hear music all the time. People are listening to music all the time, and everybody loves music. It's just, you know, what kind of music. And I wanted people to understand that if they don't like Mozart, but they do like Tchaikovsky, that's really okay, too, because most people who love classical music don't love all of it. You know, so they'll say, well, I mean, I really can't stand Renaissance music, or, oh, I hate modern music, whatever it is. But I go to the symphony every week, you know. So it's kind of a mirror of who you are. And the response to music is really emotional. And I wanted people to feel empowered to say, I like that, or I don't like that, and never say, I don't know very much about music, but. Because, you know, you and everybody listening, we all have opinions about stuff. What food we like, or what car we want, or what color we like, right? It doesn't matter. Everybody's got an opinion about everything, sports, you know, politics, God knows. But when it comes to music, sometimes people say, well, I just don't know anything about it. No. You know everything about it. If you don't like it, that's okay. If you're curious about it, then pursue it. But so it's meant to be a kind of an all-encompassing book. The book is also, I thought, for the love of music, is a kind of perfect present. Either give yourself. You know, I dedicate the book to my Aunt Rose and my Aunt Jenny and my brother Bob. And they were, and of course, Leonard Bernstein. But my two aunts were just opened the door for me as their nephew when I was a little kid. I don't know what they saw in me, but they did. And my brother, who is 3.5 years older than I am, you know, I would be his pal. And he, of course, got a driver's license before I did. We lived outside of New York City. And so I would hang out with him. And it's about how to share this love with other people. And that was really the other point of the book.
You say in the book, this is music that is easy to understand once you agree to open yourself to it, even when the jargon can be confusing and off-putting.
Yep.
But the jargon is an attempt to translate music into nouns and verbs and the descriptive words that modify them. How can that jargon be challenging?
Well, because you're going to hear words like recapitulation or jargon, whatever field you're interested in has got its own set of vocabulary, right? So if it's golf, there are words that people use to describe it. If it's cooking, whatever it is that you live in or are comfortable with, or what you ever were schooled in, or there's words. If you're a farmer, there's all kinds of words that other people can't figure out. And music, because it's invisible, people want to persuade other people to love what they love. I mean, that's a normal human thing. I was once described as a contagious enthusiast, which is very sweet, I have to say, and I hope to think I am. So if I love something, I want you to love it too, and let me tell you why. The difficulty here is that while we can set out certain things that tell you this is interesting, because, I mean, so many ways to address music. You know, there's the historical way. I mean, there's what was happening in the world at that time. What is the composer intending? What do I feel when I hear this? And that's good too. Because what happens is that every time you hear a piece of music, it becomes part of your personal history. So it's not only the history of Beethoven or Tchaikovsky or Gershwin or Leonard Bernstein, but it's your personal history of when you hear it. So a lot of people will say, well, I remember the first time I heard such and such, and then it becomes part of your story. So the jargon is created for, you know, composers to know how to get from here to there in a piece of music. But I mean, look, an octave, most people know what an octave is because they can think of a piano. But there are 12 notes in an octave, and O-C-T-A-V-E means eight. So how could there be 12 notes in a word that's called eight? So again, that could make people go, oh, okay, I'm out of here. But in point of fact, it really doesn't matter whether you know the jargon or not, because it either speaks to you or it doesn't. And in between music you really don't like, first time you hear it, or music that you really want to pursue, is this other gray area of, that's kind of interesting. I don't quite understand it. I'd like to hear it again. And we're living at a time when music can be accessed so easily. Imagine what this conversation would have been like 100 years ago or 150 years ago. You wouldn't be able to hear new music by Beethoven or Tchaikovsky without going to the concert. And then you'd hear it once. And then you'd say, well, I liked it, or I didn't, and I wonder what's going to come next. But now we have this world of music, not only what's happening all over the world right now, but also we go back in time. So we have access to every kind of culture and almost every kind of music. This is a glorious time when you love music. And if you hold in your mind, this is a human invention. We humans made this for each other. It's not an alien thing, and it's not been foisted on us. We created it. And although we might talk about a bird song or the songs of a whale, that's nothing compared to that. We start to, you know, anthropomorphize animals. We always do, right? We'll wave to a fish that's staring at us on the other side of a tank, right? Mm. As if the fish actually understands what it means for a human to wave at it. But really, we created music. It's us. And it permeates our lives. We invented it. It's a unique thing. And as I said, because it's invisible and because it didn't till our land, it didn't feed our children, and yet we persisted in creating instruments. Every time, think about this, every time there was a technological development, we discover how to make bronze. What do? Well, yeah, we make weapons. We make armor, we make gongs, we make instruments. There are trumpets made of metal in King Tut's tomb. Trumpets. Why do they make trumpets? And they made them first out of bone, and then they made them out of wood, and they made them out of brass, once metallurgy. So every time there's a technological development, we tend to use that to make more instruments and more music and more sounds. And that's pretty amazing. So I just wanted the reader own it, to know that music is us and we are it.
John Malcheri is our guest. The name of the new book is For the Love of Music, A Conductor's Guide to the Art of Listening. You were a protege of Bernstein's, a colleague for 18 years. You write about in the book, there's a chapter, as you mentioned earlier, called Pay Attention. And you write, a lot of citizen arrests are made in concerts where there is a pause after a movement of a symphony because the people who are shushing firmly believe that in order to comprehend the totality of a symphony, everyone should go from start to finish without the interaction or interruption of the audience. How did Bernstein feel about that?
We never really talked about that, but he was, you know, as human and humane a person as I ever knew. I know that he conducted symphonies in various parts of the world, right? So when he was in Vienna, there was the tradition not to applaud between movements, whereas in New York, there might be. But I think he would have understood that composers intended for there to be applause. I mean, really, you can't get to the end of the march from the Pathetique Symphony without applauding. I mean, that's how Tchaikovsky wrote it. If you don't applaud, it just seems like an unnatural act. And you conduct it as a finale because the point of that movement in the Pathetique is that you think it's a triumphant ending. And then Tchaikovsky appends to it a tragic ending, which is unique in history of music up until that point, because every piece of music usually, or almost 99% of the time, ends with uplift. But in my conversations with Leonard Bernstein over the years, he did not seem to ever express, discomfiture over applause between a second and third movement within a four-movement piece. It's really, when composers didn't want that, they kind of linked those movements. In other words, in Beethoven's Fifth, you get to the last movement without a break. There's no place to applaud. In his Emperor Concerto, the second and third movements are linked together. We also know from world premieres that when audiences really liked a movement, they would applaud and they'd have to be repeated. So I think there are two points of view here. If you feel like you love it, you should just applaud. This is a collective decision of audiences. Now, this is also an interesting point. I do make a pretty long point about why a live performance is so special. It's not just that you should only hear music that way, but there's something about the societal. We all get together and sit in the dark and stare at the stage where there's a concert going on. It's something that's so, again, so human. Why do we do that? Well, what happens in the great performances is there's a sense of collective support, a little bit like what happens in a sports event. If you look at it, say, a tennis match, singles, so that there are two people playing, the audience, the fans, are usually rooting for one of the two of them. And, of course, in that case, the audience is bifurcated with two different kinds of, I'm rooting for you and I'm not rooting for you. Sometimes a great tennis champ will be in a situation where the audience is not rooting for him or her, and they have to overcome that. But in a concert, what happens is because there's only one thing happening, is that there's music and there's the audience. And when they decide in some kind of strange, wonderful alchemy that they are a single entity and they support the music, then everyone is a co-performer. I just had this happen 2 weeks ago. After I've written this book, obviously, I was in Paris and I was conducting Danny Elfman's violin concerto with the orchestra of Brussels. And it was Paris. We were in the Philharmonie. And there's the opening piece, which I conducted. And then I left the stage. I came out with a soloist, Sandy Cameron, and we started the concerto. Now, Danny Elfman's violin concerto, which, in fact, she and I recorded recently, it starts with just the cellos, and the cellos are playing really quietly. That's for two slow beats. And then the next bar starts with the basses who come in with the cellos. So it's really quiet. Then the violin starts really quietly. What the audience did in that maybe 10-second period of time, you actually felt, I felt in the, through my back, a few thousand people suddenly all paid attention and gave their attention and support to the piece and to us. When that happens, there's no such thing as a mistake anymore. And everybody is performing. Everyone is on the trampoline or is a spotter. No one's going to fall. Everyone's going to jump. Everyone's going to do all the most amazing things, which is why I always say that, you will never get rid of live concert performances. It's just part of who we are as humans. We're lucky to have recordings. We're lucky to have broadcasts. We're lucky to have those things. But this is the moment where we all participate. It's just a glorious moment. And it's unpredictable, mind you. We would like to see that happen all the time. But when it happens, it's huge.
And as a conductor, how aware, you're aware, of course, of the sound of the orchestra. Are you aware of how the piece is being listened to?
Well, yeah, actually, it's very interesting because we conductors, my first book, which is called Maestros and Their Music, The Art and Alchemy of Conducting, we're always dealing with kind of three periods of time: what just happened, what is happening, and what's about to happen. It's one way to look at it. We've just played something. We're at the moment where these notes are being sounded, and we are looking further down the road, just like a driver would. We know what's coming. We're telling the story. We have the recipe. We have the book in front of us. The audience is responding. Sometimes there's a cough. Sometimes A soloist within the orchestra takes a little bit more time on something. Sometimes just this magical moment where you hold on to the silence a little bit longer before the next note comes in. You're always judging that. And so, you know, the back of your neck is really a place where a conductor has got receptors. And it's not just our ears on the sides of our head and our brains and, of course, our hearts and all of the planes of our body, which are telegraphing to the orchestra the meaning of what their individual lines mean. Because the orchestra is so smart. Orchestras are really smart. They are navigating so many different elements, and the conductor is indicating by his or her body and gestures how that all fits together. Even if they've played this, the piece before, even if they've played it, you know, 1,000 times before, it's a different person, different heart, different spirit up there pulling people together, shaping them. But at the same time, we're absolutely aware of what's going on behind us. We're like the lightning rod. We're in the middle of this. We're not only the perpetrator, but we're the first ones to get hit with the sound. I mean, we are right there. That's part of why we're all a little bit crazy. We're certainly a little bit crazy in the sense that when a performance is over, you know, we appear to be normal people. You know, we talk, we shake hands, we thank people if they come back or whatever. But it's like having a low-grade electrical current running through you because you really are in the middle of this and you don't make a sound. You see, it's this kind of mysterious world we live in. So that's why I wrote the first book to all the people who were to share with them not only what we're doing up on the stage, but how they're feeling and how they can open themselves up more to the experience of music. Because basically, joins us together as human beings. It's beyond culture and race and gender and everything. It is the thing that makes us human. So insofar as we all live on this planet together, and the music that I'm writing about, which used to be called Western music, is a music that has been adopted by the entire world. Because the language of this music, the language of Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and Gershwin and Danny Elfman and whoever you want to add to this, is a language that was first described by the Greeks, you know, 5,000 years ago. And it's music that has been influenced by every music in the world, because all of the imperialism and all of the missionaries, whenever they went out to other cultures, those cultures and their music was then added to the language of this large musical language, which starts being described by the Greeks and then the Romans. So it does encapsulate an entire history of humanity and of individual cultures in one language that can make reference to the specificity of those areas, but basically is talking to everybody. And by the way, you did mention about film music when you introduced me. Yes. And yes, and part of what was the thing that spread Western music more than anything, more than the Jesuits, more than the Roman army, was the movies. And because the first composers of talking pictures were all trained in the European conservatories, and then 10 years later, they were all American-born guys who were trained in American conservatories. And so, and then it continues on with the adoption of jazz and whatever, whoever is writing music today, but it's all part of this language. And everybody goes to the movies. So the whole language was taught, as it were. So that's why, you know, while we're having this conversation, you know, we might think for a moment about how astonishing it is that the country called China has got a number of Western symphony orchestras that have been created in the recent past. Whatever is in the news today, whatever city is being referenced, there is probably a Western symphony orchestra in that city. And whereas we might eat food from different cultures in whatever city you're in, you'll find that we experience certain aspects of those cultures. But when it comes to the music, we do not. We do not in New York City have, you know, three or four kabuki theaters. We do not have, you know, Turkish instrumental ensembles in New York City. We can eat Turkish food. We can eat lots of different kinds of Chinese and Japanese food. But the music doesn't come back in the other direction, even though there are influences of Turkish music. I mean, my goodness, every time the cymbals are crashed in a symphony, that's Turkey. That's the Turkish people. Mm. They invented that. They used metallurgy and figured out a way to spin that and make those round crashing sounds that can make so many different sounds. The Chinese with their gongs and wind chimes and their string instruments. And, you know, so that's what makes this such an interesting story. And that's the goal of the book, is to kind of describe that. As you can see, I rather like music.
That is evident in our conversation and, of course, in the book as well. The name of the book is For the Love of Music, A Conductor's Guide to the Art of Listening. It is published by Knopf. John Malcherry, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for spending time with me, and I hope you have a beautiful rest of your day.
And to you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Again, John Malcherry is our guest. The name of the book is For the Love of Music, A Conductor's Guide to the Art of Listening. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.